Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So welcome back to The Thistle. We are here for a very special episode with Mark Evans. A bit of background about Mark. He was director of rugby at Saracens and then CEO at Harlequins before turning to the dark side, moving to rugby league with the Melbourne Storm in Australia, and also chairing the Vitality Netball Super League in the UK. Most recently, he was in charge of the Western Force's re-entry to professional rugby via Andrew Forrest's Global Rapid Rugby. And he's also authored the book Unholy Union, which is a fascinating look at how rugby has dealt with the sport becoming professional that I would highly recommend people getting their hands on. Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and thanks for inviting me on.
No, absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time. So, Mark, you've clearly had a sort of varied and really fascinating career. You've been described in some media outlets as a kind of a free thinker within rugby, and even rugby's iconoclast in chief. Would you agree with this assessment, and how would you sort of sum up your career to date?
I wouldn't agree with it, actually. I think I've got a sort of... but I do like to... I am quite passionate about trying to grow the game, and I do feel that in lots of its traditional territories, we don't organise it in the most sensible way to drive things forward, given that, you know, like all sports, rugby has got certain challenges. And I get very irritated, I suppose, by it can be a little bit pompous. And I hate this idea that rugby's a middle-class sport, because I was brought up in South Wales. Although I define as British, because I've got a Glaswegian mother, a Welsh father, and I was born, albeit not for very long, in England and brought up in Wales, and all my grandparents are Irish. So I very strongly. It'd be hard to be anything else. But I grew up in an area where rugby was played by everybody across the classes, and I've always felt it pigeonholed itself far too comfortably, and accepted this idea that it was really a game for largely, you know, private schools and class kids, and you know, coming from where I come from, and you know, parts of the West Country and parts of South France, and you know, go and tell that to somebody in Fiji or parts. I just find it incredibly unambitious. So maybe that's where it comes from. I mean, really, that was what the book was about. It was about, you know, I think the subtitle was, you know, when rugby collided with the modern world, and the idea was actually, we missed out as a sport on 100 years or on 100 years really between the split between rugby league and rugby union in 1895 and professionalism in 1995. And 100 years really passed when lots of other sports had its teething problems and made its mistakes and found its way. And rugby, we just sort of, we didn't. We just sort of sat there, pickled in aspic. To a large degree, until the commercial pressures became so great that it had to change. So we have this image that I quite like, not mine, you know, my co-author who's the wordsmith and far more erudite than myself, had this idea that rugby is like a slingshot, and it was held there for 100 years and nothing moved, and then suddenly it was released and it was catapulted into the 21st century. And with all the problems that brings, and yet all the opportunities it brings. And that's really what it's about. It's about how does a sport that stayed still for so long and is now like developing so quickly, how does it manage itself? That's really what it's about.
And for the people who haven't read the book, I mean, how would you best sum up that inability of rugby as a sport to embrace professionalism, to embrace modernization? Is it just because we, you know, professional rugby is you know, pretty immature in the context of other global sports like football, or are there any sort of particular problems that the sport hasn't been able to overcome?
I think there are some in different territories, to be honest. There's no one answer to that. I think in some areas it's to do with its historical sort of the way it developed historically and its heritage. So it was quite colonial, you know, with the exception of France. And it had all this kind of very, quite attractive. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love bits of this, the whole amateur ethos thing that was very, very strong, that comes from the English public schools. And there were some good things about that. There really were, but it got well past its sell-by date. And then I suppose, I don't think the transition was particularly well managed, particularly in England, actually. And I also think people probably didn't look around globally and look at models that were successful. They sort of blindly went on, and to a degree partly tried to copy football, which is a really big mistake, because football's the exception. It's the only true global sport. There is not really another genuinely global team sport that is played played significantly in all the major countries of the world, or even most of the major countries of the world. There just isn't one. Football is the only one, and that's even quite recent. I mean, you used to be able to make the argument that, well, you say you're global, but you haven't got the States, you haven't got India, and you haven't got China. Well, that's an awful lot of people you haven't got. But you can't really say that anymore. In the last 30 years, it's making big strides in India, it's made huge strides in the United States, and it's making a bit two steps forward, one step back in China. So it is a global sport, and therefore its market is so big that it can afford to make an awful lot of mistakes and still be very successful, because it's so deeply ingrained in the culture of so many countries. And the reasons for that are many and various, and it's partly to do with naval routes, and it's partly to do with the ease playing it, and it's partly to do with a whole load of other factors, which can't be replicated. You know, you hear, if there's one thing I'd sort of, it makes me squirm and feel, you know, oh, here we go again. You know, people say, oh yeah, but in football, I mean, no, please don't say that, because it's a completely false analogy. You know, find me another sport that does what you think we should do that isn't football. Because football, you know, what's happened in football? Well, it's a global sport, and all the best players play in four leagues in Northwest Europe. It's just that, well, fine. You know, it doesn't matter where you're from. You know, not a single Belgium international plays in Belgium. Not a single. Well, that's not true anymore. It used to be true of France, but it's not anymore, because since the investment in Paris Saint-Germain and Marseille, that's not true. But still, most don't. And so all the talent is concentrated into four leagues. Well, and that it's allowed. Market forces can just about work because the market is so damn big. Mm. There's no other sport that can do that. So you're silly to try. Anyway, that's one of the big risks through the thing.
And so what, sort of through your experience of different sports and organisations, what is there any sport that kind of represents a good template for rugby to follow?
It depends which country you're talking about. So, for example, at its most basic, there are only maybe three countries in the world that have got a big enough rugby market to have a standalone national professional league. So England can do it, the market's big enough.
Mm-hmm.
France can do it. France is the biggest rugby market mm-hmm. in the world. About 25 million people in France would say rugby is their sport of choice. And that's the biggest rugby market in the world. Because the size of the market is irrelevant. It doesn't matter, you know, that there are over a billion people in China is largely irrelevant because hardly anyone plays it. It doesn't matter, it's a billion people. And the third one's Japan. Japan can and does support a solely domestic league. But everybody else from South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, all the Celtic nations, Italy, et al. United States might in time prove to be the fourth. Have to partner. They just have to partner. If they want, you can still play rugby in a national league, but you can't play it full time. There aren't enough viewers, there aren't enough fans, there isn't a big enough market to generate the revenues you need to have let's say a minimum of 10 teams or maybe even 8. They just aren't. And that's just a fact. Everyone goes on, and there's a chapter in the book about how well Ireland have managed the transition, and to a degree that is undoubtedly true. Ireland's performance since 95 is way in advance of what it had been in most of the preceding decades. But they couldn't survive on their own. They need Scotland, they need Wales, they need to play in a transnational competition, because unlike Gaelic football, for example, in the same country, it simply hasn't got a deep enough penetration into 6 million people to support a domestic league.
And it's really interesting you say that, because obviously, as you say, Ireland have handled that transition well, whereas someone like Scotland have gone from a position of, you know, you mentioned it in the book, like winning five nations, having a pretty good record against the likes of Wales and Ireland, to in the professional era doing pretty poorly. I mean, what do you think were the main differences between Scotland and someone like Ireland through that period of transition?
Well, I think you're cherry picking a little bit, if you don't mind me saying.
No, fair enough.
You could pick another period in Scotland's pre-professional history when they were far, far worse than they have been since. So, you know, you go to the early 50s. What was it? Scotland went how many games without a win? Was it 51 to 55? They were the Italy of their day.
Yeah.
Scotland's a relatively... Actually, it's an interesting comparison, isn't it, between Scotland and Ireland, yeah? Roughly similar populations. Ireland's a bit bigger, isn't it? Ireland's about 6 and a bit, and Scotland's 5 and a bit. I think I've got that right. I don't think I'm too far out. I've done that for ages. But Scotland, you look at the sporting landscape, Scotland football is the national game. Okay, professional football therefore takes a huge chunk of the viewing numbers and the physical attendees, and it's played at the same time of the year. Seasons are almost identical, you know, so traditionally September to May, exactly the same, complete overlap. Ireland, there isn't really another winter sport. The Gaelic sports are played between February and September. And it's the largest country in Europe without a professional football league. Now, that you cannot underestimate how important that is in terms of leaving a window open for another sport that is predominantly winter. The whole of the September to February window was effectively And, you know, I'm sure you will see it, well, you see it because they come to the boats that leave Ireland, North and the Republic, every weekend during the football season for Glasgow, Manchester, Liverpool.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. You know, countries much smaller than Ireland have got a professional football league. You know, Belgium's not that much bigger than Ireland, and they've got their own. Portugal, 9 million people. They've got their own. Yeah, Benfica and Porto and all the rest of it. So Scotland more like that. It's more like Portugal and those sort of, which doesn't leave a lot of room for rugby as the second winter sport.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Ireland hasn't really got one. So to say Ireland have managed it better, this may or may not be true. It's hard to measure that. What you can undoubtedly say is that the situation they inherited was significantly easier. And that, you know, that they had an empty market with very little competition, and at the same time, they happened to be organised into four traditional provinces with heritage.
Yeah.
So they didn't have the sort of, and this is the Welsh argument always, that the Irish had, you know, Leinster and Munster and Ulster and Connacht have, you know, they go back for centuries above and beyond rugby, so you have a real sense of identity and belonging.
Mm-hmm.
You don't manufacture them. And I think there's something in that. However, I do think the Irish managed the rise of Connacht beautifully. I mean, I remember Connacht when they were, you know, there were a couple of thousand there if you were lucky on the race course, you know, and I remember taking teams there, and it was, you know, didn't feel like much like professional rugby at the time.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of criticism at the Irish Union that they were underfunding them and they weren't giving them, but actually they sort of had a plan, and it took a while, but, you know, they are a pretty strong province now. And who would ever have thought that 20 years ago, where Gaelic was so dominant in Connacht? Scotland, you know, a smaller, you know, much more competitive. The population spread is different in Scotland. You know, you've got your two very big cities, you know, and they dominate the population density in a way that, all right, Dublin does dominate Ireland, I do accept that, you know, there are, you know, Cork and Limerick and Belfast are not insignificant populations. And I just think it was easier. I think maybe Scotland made a mistake of trying to do four at the beginning.
Yeah.
I thought at the time that was extraordinarily ambitious, given their spectator base as much as their play base. I mean, that's always been Scotland's, not just Scotland, there are other countries similar. If you have a relatively small playing base, you will almost certainly have a relatively small spectator base. Because the correlation between playing numbers and people who show an interest in turning up and paying good money to watch, either in person or on broadcast, is incredibly strong.
Yeah.
You know, most of the research would say, well, I'll ask you the question now. We never met other than not prepared for this, but you obviously love the game, okay? Who took you to your very first rugby match?
It would have been my dad.
That, okay, along with, I don't know, 95% of people, you were introduced to the game by somebody you loved who either played it or watched it themselves. Correct?
Yeah.
There we are, right. So, if your playing base isn't growing or very large, growing a spectator base is really difficult. Really, really difficult. Unless, and here is the difference with Ireland again, unless the market we talk about is completely empty. So, in other words, there's nothing else to watch. And I remember in the late 90s with a bunch of friends who worked in sport, in different sports, and because we were a bit nerdy, you know, a couple of coaches and commercial guys and sponsorship guys and marketing people, and we used to play these sort of, right, if you could take over any sports club anywhere in Europe, who would it be? But you weren't allowed to say Leinster Rugby relatively too easy.
Okay, yeah.
That was before Leinster at that stage were like tiny. Mm. But every business knew, God, look at that market. It's just empty.
Mm.
Come on, guys, get on with it. It's an open goal. And eventually they did, and look at it now. But, you know, it was all there waiting to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've got an empty market, the relationship between participation numbers, and it hasn't got to be an adult even, just to play it at school, to have played minis, to have, or to know somebody who did, or
yeah,
a friend, or an uncle, or a sister, or, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. If you haven't got a big playing base, it's really difficult to get a sort of cultural roots down.
Mm.
For the sport. Mm. And without that, it's very hard to get people to watch it on a regular basis. They'll turn up for a big event, they'll try it for a while, or as a novelty thing. They'll turn up for really big things like the World Cup or whatever. But week in, week out, season tickets, you know, turning up come hell or high water 10, 12 times a season, you've got to have an affinity with the sport. And that's why it's always going to be a struggle in Scotland in a way that it shouldn't be, for instance, in Wales.
Yeah.
Now, Wales' problem is that it's even fewer people. You know, it's even fewer people. You know, it's don't play rugby in North Wales to any great degree. I apologise to my North Walian friends, but, you know, it's very dominated by the football of Merseyside, to be honest. Although it's better than it was. But, you know, so whereby, you know, North Wales, all right, it does produce the odd player, of course, but, you know, not much in the way of people and not much in the way of fan base. So you're trying to build an audience in Wales from about 2 million people in 80-mile corridor.
Yeah.
Where also got Cardiff City and Swansea City, who in the recent years both had stints in the Premiership.
Mm.
And they also have the same problem Scotland has, which is they're sitting right next to an independent national league with higher wages.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's very, very easy as a player, easier from Wales than it is from Scotland, because from Wales you don't even have to move.
Mm.
You can live in Cardiff and play for Worcester or Bath, Bristol. Exeter's a bit of a stretch, but even that's possible.
Mm.
So it's terribly easy. So Wales, which has got the cultural resonance and a bigger playing base, has got other issues as well. But I've heard decent, and you know the numbers better than me, but I may have got this wrong, so you know, correct me if I have, but I think there's been a bit of movement on the participation in numbers in Scotland in the last 20 years.
There has been. I think there's potentially some disagreement about how those players are actually defined and accounted for, the figures may be slightly massaged, but yeah, I mean, you make the point in your book that, and this still just astounds me, that, you know, Sri Lanka, Kenya and China have more registered players in Scotland. Maybe China makes more sense just because of sort of the arithmetic. But
Italy has more registered players than Wales.
Really, I didn't know that. But then I suppose like a couple of questions come from that, you know, is, I think Scottish rugby is always sort of crying out for a third pro team. And I think that particularly after bad losses, that the clamour becomes greater. But is that desirable?
Can you talk me through the thinking behind that? Because my first, and I wouldn't claim to be an expert on Scottish rugby at all or its structures, but my gut feel reaction to that is, oh my God, don't be stupid. There must be, what's the thinking behind it?
Well, I think the thinking is that it's very difficult to build depth across key positions. So, for instance, at standoff, you know, you had a period of time where Finn Russell, Adam Hastings and Duncan Weir were all playing at Glasgow. And the knock-on effect of that is when there are injuries, which obviously happen in international rugby, you have to call up guys who haven't been playing any rugby. And I think you've seen that recently in Scottish camps, particularly around the front row, where our depth isn't great anyway. But someone like Murray McCallum, who tight head prop for Edinburgh, who has hardly played any professional games, he gets called up to a Scotland squad, and you know he'll put in a good effort and have a manful performance. But I think the logic is, or the argument behind another team is, that it would give these guys chances to play week in, week out, and build depth across Scottish rugby, I think is the key argument, really.
Okay, so that's interesting. But I'd immediately say, who's going to pay for it?
Yeah.
That's my first question. Who's going to watch it? Why would you create another Scottish team in the Pro 14/16? So who's going to give up a team? Because otherwise that competition structure doesn't work. And I fully understand the argument of depth and only having two teams, and therefore in positions you can be left looking pretty thin. But I think the question there must be, are you able to turn the what appears to be the disadvantage of being next to another big rugby market, or next to two quite big rugby markets of England and France, or even other teams in the Pro 14. I mean, look how Ireland benefited. Ireland have done, again, quite well. Mm. And there are some signs of Scotland starting to do this, which might be a better and a more cost-effective solution. Now, Ty Burn, you know, who played with Scarlet, magnificently, I wonder. And then as soon as he got really good, they whistled and he went back because he wanted to play for Ireland. Understandably, I mean, I remember back in the day, we had a tight end when I was at Queens. Goodness me, his name Ross.
Mike Ross.
Mike Ross, of course, who we Dean, you know, picked out from a you know very modest sort of background, turned him into a starting tight end for us. Went to a you know advanced second in the league, decent Highland Cup run. Then he was off. He went back to Ireland and got multiple caps. Now, you know, you've got to be able. You know, you can't afford to stack because players spin their wheels and get frustrated and all the rest of it. And it's just not a good. It's not a good use of talent. It's not good talent management. But to say the answer to that is, oh, we'll put a third team, which means you have to create another squad of another 40 players.
Mm.
Another 40 salaries, and I'm not sure Scotland have got the player base to populate because they're not going to be full mainly of Scots people. What's the point? Scots qualified players. What's the point? I mean, I would take a lot of persuading that the answer to the depth problem, which I recognise is a genuine problem when you've only got two teams, I'm not convinced that having a third team is necessarily the answer. I think there are cleverer ways to ensure that if you have got four fly halves of you think professional quality, that you ensure that they're all playing. Now, whether they're playing for Glasgow, Edinburgh or elsewhere, but can be called upon, I think that's probably... And you might reach a tipping point at some point whereby the participation numbers, if they, you know, and I take your point about how they're calculated, that's true in most countries, but if there isn't, there has to be, and if there is, then great, keep it going. But if the participation numbers are particularly of juniors, or particularly of some 6 to 18 year olds, are growing, there may come a point where you hit a tipping point. Maybe. You've still got the commercial problems, where's the audience, where are they going to play? And frankly, I mean, Glasgow and Edinburgh have had their successes. You know, and Glasgow, you know, I really admire what's happened to Glasgow. I always thought, I and I was wrong. I was thought there were three cities in the UK where rugby would never get a serious hold because football was so strong. And mm-hmm. I thought Liverpool was one, and neither code is correct, Liverpool. Manchester to a degree, but there was always Sale.
Mm.
So that was all, you know, just about. I thought Glasgow, I just couldn't ever see it.
Yeah.
I think what's done there has been magnificent.
Mm.
And my other one was Newcastle, and, you know, one team town, and it's a religion. But the Falcons have just kept battering away. There are good people running them, and they can't out a niche.
Mm.
A bit like Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where would you put it, Matt? You can't put another team in Glasgow or another team in Edinburgh. So where do you base it? Don't say borders.
We've done another one of the hosts of the podcast, Alan's done a big sort of deep dive on this, and he's factored in all these things like population base, income levels, professional football or other professional sports nearby, and it's really difficult. Like, I don't think anyone has come up with a good solution, and so far
surprised.
I don't think
you do the English model, right? It's always good to learn from other countries. So in England you go, because you get the same arguments in England, why can't we have a team in X, you know, put it, insert your town here, and the answer is, well, have a look around, see the ones that have worked. The teams that have worked, and I say worked in a very loose sense, because the English club model is bust. Okay, so but has worked as well as any other team. Put it that way, all right. So try and separate the two issues. So take Worcester, or take Exeter, or take Northampton. Okay. What's the model? Or Gloucester. Take the model. Well, it's a town of at least 120,000-130,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Surrounded by another 300 or so, making a sort of catchment area of 500,000.
Mm.
Here's the thing, with no significant other football code.
Yeah.
Right? So Exeter, football in Exeter, they have got a football team, but they're level 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Gloucester has not got I'm sure it has, but they have no professional football team. They've got one in Cheltenham, 3-4 miles mm-hmm. away, but smaller town. Worcester has only got a cricket club. Right? Northampton, their team's level 3 or 4, and they've got 300,000 people. Now, if you've got that, evidence suggests you can build a rugby town, a team representing that town stroke area successfully. But somewhere like Bedford, for instance, which is a rugby town, right?
Mm.
Bedford is a rugby town, got no football, but it's only got 80,000 people. And you go too far up the road, you run into Northampton, right? It just hasn't. Mm. You talk to Bedford, they have a lovely little ground, really good, great tradition, great heritage.
Mm-hmm.
They simply haven't got enough people, and wishing won't make it so.
Mm.
I admire Bedford. They recognise we can only go to level 2. Our market isn't big enough.
Mm.
And if you've got other codes in your area, like football or rugby league, it will not work. You need a much bigger town then. So Leeds is a really good example, right? Everyone says Yorkshire in England has got the second highest number of clubs in the country after Surrey.
Yeah.
As a constituent body, okay? 6 million people live in Yorkshire. I don't know how many rugby union clubs it's got, but it's a hell of a lot, okay? And Leeds has got 700,000 people living in the city. The county's got 6 million people. And you think, surely that must work. But they have tried it in Leeds time and time and time again with absolutely first-class management. Gary Hetherington is one of the best rugby administrators of either code I've ever come across anywhere in the world. But they've got football.
Mm-hmm.
Leeds United. They've got rugby league. Leeds Rhino.
Yeah.
There's not enough left to support a premiership rugby team.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried and tried and tried, and it can't be done. Now, if it can't be done in Leeds and Yorkshire, with a market of 6 million and a city of 750,000, what on earth makes people think you can do it in an area with, I think the last time I looked, a total population of about 50,000 and the largest settlement of 22?
Yeah, there's quite a good sort of, I don't know if it's anecdotal, but story that Leeds or Yorkshire as a county at under 16 level has more registered players than the whole of Scotland.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
So, you know, that's...
I don't know if that's true, but I wouldn't be... The population's roughly similar.
Yeah.
It is probably... But, so, I think... And this is where things have changed. It used not to matter very much because the cost base was so low. So Gala could be a premium team, okay? Or Hoyt. Or go to another country and say, you know, Limerick used to support three really quite strong teams, you know, in the city. The point is, you couldn't have three professional teams in Limerick.
Mm.
You had one professional team in the whole region. You know, I know it's a terribly attractive idea and it appeals to our sense of history and all the rest of it, but it's totally impractical.
Mm.
And it's very interesting. You go, well, where would you put another team in England if you wanted to? A country of 55 million people. And the answer is there's very, very few places. And by the way, you've got to have a stadium as well.
Yeah, yeah.
If you haven't got one, you've got to build one.
Have you got a view on the role of the Exiles teams and, you know, someone like London Scottish as potentially being a base for third pro team for Scotland?
Yeah, and I've heard the same thing about London Welsh and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what competition are they going to play?
I mean, could they... I mean, it does seem as if the pro 16, whatever it is adding teams the whole time. So I think... You know, potentially the idea of a team based in London with that market with quite a strong Exile population.
Why do you want to go into a market where you've got London Irish 2 miles up the road?
Yeah, for sure.
You've got Harlequins 3 miles up the road?
Mm.
And, you know, this is my same argument about Ealing Trailfinders, who are about 5 miles away. That market is gone. That market is saturated.
Mm.
And I know people say, oh, that's not how we talk about sport. Well, no, I'm sorry, it is. That's exactly how you should talk about it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think those sorts of discussions largely are a diversion. Now, they're terribly romantic and they're terribly attractive. And I'm as prone to them as the next guy.
Mm.
But they're not going to happen. No, the first winners of, what was it, the two winners of the, take a different sport, but the two winners before rugby league broke away, in the last two, they had, you know, the Yorkshire Cup and the Lancashire Cup, 1894-5. And one was won by Liver's Edge, that was the Yorkshire Cup, and the other one was run by a tiny little place just outside Lee, Tinningley, I've got that wrong, but it's something like that, a little mining village. That's great, I love all that stuff. But it's totally irrelevant.
Mm.
And what you want to do with those sorts of places is keep... They can provide still, however, a really big part of your participation base. You know, again, look at Rugby League. Castleford, which is a 50,000 people in... No, not that many in Castleford. It's one of the five towns in Normanton, and it's the old coal field on in West.
Yeah.
They still produce an extraordinary number of players, far, far, far more than Castleford can absorb.
Mm.
And I think that's great, because there are other places where they don't produce many at all, but they've got enough people to make up an audience, you know? And in the borders of Scotland, if it were me, I would be, you know, you invest there to keep participation high and to keep a high level of participation, if you know what I mean. In other words, not raw numbers. others, but, you know, a disproportionate number of very skillful players who can play the game at a high that should never be allowed to die.
Yeah.
But any decent program has to always have pressure coming from below. Let me give you an example. If you're in a salary cap league and you don't cheat, I don't think you can win the Premiership without a significant proportion of homegrown players coming up through your own development systems.
Yeah.
Because there just isn't enough money in the salary cap to buy a championship winning team and import them all from elsewhere. I actually don't think it can be done unless you're... So let me take, for example, I was at the Melbourne Storm, seen the NRL for a few years, a CEO there, and we did a bit of a read, and we had an incredible run of success in a league that is meant to actually have cycles. You're not meant to stay at the top for very long. And one of the key points of that success has been, and if anyone thinks, oh, yeah, that was a salary cap scandal, I'm talking after that. That was over a decade ago. Being the salary cap for many, many years. They constantly identify and develop huge numbers of players from 17, 18, 19 years old from other parts of the country, because there's not much rugby league played in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So they recruit them at 17, 18, 19. They develop them, and they are always moving players on at the other end as their salaries increase, because they've got other players coming through.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's true at international level as well. And if you haven't got, and some countries don't because their playing base is so small, but others don't because their development systems are poor. I don't know if we mentioned this yet. If we mentioned this earlier.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting just to hear your views on project players, the residency qualification process overall. Like, is it just the realities of the sport and like the world we live in today? Or, you know, I think Scotland fans would look at someone like Doohan van der Merwe, who we've loved having for Edinburgh and Scotland, but as soon as he's qualified, he's then moved away to Worcester. It just doesn't maybe look that great.
Well, okay. There's two quite separate issues here, and I'll take them. I will take them as separate issues. The whole idea of qualification for international rugby, I have got, you've read the book, so beautifully written by Michael Aylwin, so you'll know that we were and continue to be very, very critical of 3-year qualification, which has now gone to 5. I would actually go to 7. Now, because you have to be careful for unintended consequences, you're not careful, you'll end up, as has happened in other sports, with very rich clubs in richer unions starting to warehouse 15, 16, 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
Saying, well, that's okay, because at 24, they'll be qualified for us. So I'm massively against that, because it really damages countries like Fiji and Samoa. I think that's my big thing is about the growth of the game. So that basically means that countries that have got quite well-developed rugby ecosystems benefit at the expense of those who don't. I mean, I feel pretty similar, by the way, about medical staff being taken from underdeveloped countries and being given and then working in Western democracies. I just don't think it's right. It's a moral objection. So in that sense I would like to see that change even further. I would also have like to see a change which says, I also think it's ridiculous that players who might have played one game for a country 5 years ago can't now go and play for another country. I mean, again, I think that's nonsense. I mean, why can't I'm trying to think of a good example.
Well, so, someone like Zach Mercer has had what, two caps for England, and he's Scottish qualified, and if he had you know, had a three-year grace period of whatever you want it to be, he would be pushing 50 caps for Scotland, 100%.
That's a very good example. I mean, if England don't, because at the moment you get this rather unpleasant situation where you can't help but thinking people get picked for one game just to capture them.
Yeah.
And then they never want it again. And look, I make a very clear distinction here. If it's someone like Cocker the Singer, who was of, or Rakanaguni, who was a serving officer in the British Army and lived in Grant. I mean, that's not the sort of player we're talking about. And, you know, so, you know, the Vunipolas, who Samoan or Tongan ancestry, I think I'm right. I apologise if I'm not. You know, but brought up in Wales, educated in England. You know, that is the modern. That's just the way migration patterns have gone. But I think rugby should change, make it longer to do it through residency, should be more liberal in terms of allowing players after a grace period to represent another country if they are qualified through parentage or birth or all that kind of stuff. And then the project player issue itself, so maybe there are three issues, not two. How do I feel about that? Well, I totally understand why countries do it, because their raison d'etre at the time is to get the strongest possible team on the park within the rules.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not criticising countries for doing that, and lots of countries have done it, England included. You know, Ben Teo, for example. Nathan Hughes. The Irish obviously do it in a pretty well-organised fashion, so do the Scots. I'm not going to criticise any country for doing it within the rules. I think, however, some of the rules are wrong. I wouldn't worry very much about, like, your man from Edinburgh, the winger, Van der Merwe, going to Worcester, isn't it?
Worcester.
Well, as long as, and I'm sure they do, as long as his agent and the Scottish management are switched on to the terms of his employment contract, it shouldn't really make much difference. I know that you get the question of, well, now they have to play in the down weeks because they're not playing in Scotland, and then, all right, that's all true, but it is increasing the pool of players who can play for Scotland.
Yeah.
You know, so you haven't reduced the number of Scottish qualified players in the two professional teams, and you've now got a very good player also qualified who happens to be playing in the Premiership. Now, I would think the argument would be strong, which says, well, now Edinburgh will be weaker because he's a fine player. And that's true. But then we come back to what we talked about earlier, which is, but that comes back to your own player pool and your own development pathways.
Yeah.
If you are, because it doesn't matter whether you're a, I mean, I've always felt this, and I suppose I feel it even more strongly now than I did a few years back. I don't think it matters whether you're a club or a country, but any decent program has to always have pressure coming from below. Let me give an example. If you're in a salary cap league and you don't cheat, I don't think you can win the Premiership without a significant proportion of homegrown players coming up through your own development systems.
Yeah.
Because there just isn't enough money in the salary cap to buy a championship winning team and import them all from elsewhere. I actually don't think it can be done unless you're... So take, for example, I was at the Melbourne Storm, seeing the NRL for a few years. a CEO there, and we did a bit of a read, and we had an incredible run of success in a league that is meant to actually have cycles. You're not meant to stay at the top for very long. Yeah. And one of the key points of that success has been, and if anyone thinks, oh, yeah, there was a salary cap scandal, I'm talking after that. That was over a decade ago.
Yeah.
Being the side of the cap for many, many years.
Mm.
They constantly identify and develop huge numbers of players from 17, 18, 19 years old from other parts of the country, because there's not much rugby league played in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So they recruit them at 17, 18, 19. They develop them, and they are always moving players on at the other end as their salaries increase, because they've got other players coming through.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's true at international level as well. And if you haven't got, and some countries don't because their playing base is so small, but others don't because their development systems are poor. I don't know if we mentioned this yesterday. Maybe we did. You edited that bit out about yesterday because it's not there. That sounds
That's terrible. Okay. No, don't worry about it.
I can't remember if we mentioned this earlier. But Italy have got more registered players than Wales.
Yeah, you did say that, yeah.
But they don't produce as many high-quality players. So you have to say the issue there is development processes rather than the player pool.
Hmm.
Okay? And that's to do with coaching and culture and all that, and schools and all that kind of stuff. So I think you'd be much, and maybe not the fans, but maybe it could be explained to them that actually a country like Scotland will stand or fall because it's a relatively.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Small country in terms of players. By looking at it and saying, right, yeah, we're going to have some very high quality development systems.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to worry too much about, we're not going to go down that route of a third team because it's incredibly expensive and it probably won't be very effective. And you'll just, you take away the competition for contracts. And if there are players in a particular position at a particular point in time, you manage them out into another league.
Yeah.
And then possibly you bring them back. And if it's happened to me in my own career, you know, sometimes, you know, you'll find a player that's just blocked. You know, you've got another one, you know, within a year. And you're thinking, you know what? Not in the player's interest. We should move that player on. And often if you can move that player on and you'd be grown up and mature about it and explain, you might be able to get them back in 3 or 4 years' time. That they're now in the national team, that should be easier because if they're qualified for Scotland, they're qualified for Scotland.
Yeah.
That's never going to change. So I think it's a, rather than get sucked into this, oh, we need a third team, or, oh, you know, we need to get them all playing in Scotland and all the rest of it. Actually, I think it's much more about, have we got very good development systems? Are we producing? Are we looking and saying, well, actually, there's a block there in that position. We need to move that guy out to get him developed. And we can't do that within Scotland at the moment. Doesn't happen very often. It does happen. But let's go and push him somewhere else. And then we can still pick him from there.
Mm.
And all the way through, keep trying. trying gradually, year on year on year on year, to widen the player pool and at the same time improve the development systems. Mm. And people can't see that always, and they're not sure where the money's going. Well, a certain percentage of your revenue should be ring-fenced to enable that to happen, because otherwise you run the risk over a generation of the standard of your national team declining. And that can't actually be fixed by project players. It can be mitigated, but it can't be fixed.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's the point you make, like when the system works in practice as the theory lays it out, like we talked about it before, Adam Hastings and Finn Russell is a perfect example of that, where Finn Russell goes to France, you say, well, okay, let's negotiate a contract with him. Okay, we can pay this much at Racing. There's no way we can justify that, but we've got Adam Hastings coming through. So I think that in those situations, I think Scotland fans can get on board with it. I mean, the other part of this would be that, as you mentioned, the kind of the homegrown players in both England and France are becoming a lot more valuable, obviously. Is the natural endpoint of that where, you know, bringing in non-English or non-French qualified players is actually not a good use of, especially the salary cap in England, for instance?
No, because it's a different system there. Because there's a separation between privately owned clubs and the union. Their agendas are not identical. They're not the same. Okay. Now, England and France have got huge advantages, the biggest one being the size of their rugby market. So they have more teams, therefore there are more contracts, there's more money, there's higher broadcast revenues, etc., etc., etc. But each club really is just looking after its own interests. Now we can have a very interesting debate about whether that's the best way to run a league, etc. But let's just leave that for a moment. And so, although there are some things in the system that encourage them to employ English players, so the GIF system system in France, and the sort of EQP system in England, it still leaves a lot of contracts for non-English or French players to take up. And the English and the French clubs play in that bit of the market that, frankly, the Scottish and the Welsh, and even the Irish to a large degree, because their system's different again, don't really play in that market. Let me give you an example. I remember when I was working in the NRL watching Samuel Adraga playing for the Parramatta Eagles, thinking, geez, what a wonderful rugby union player he would be. I mean, there's another guy at the moment who is also actually playing. I don't know what it is about the Parramatta Eels, but there's another guy.
Is it the Sivo guy?
Micah Sivo.
Yeah, he's
just sensational.
He is a total freak, that guy.
Well, I mean, and you can just see these. You think, gosh, there's another guy just gone from my old club from Melbourne to the Queensland Reds, Suliala Vinavalu.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. He's going to be wonderful. Can you absolutely wonder? Korobisi was the same.
Yeah.
Now, Radrada ended up in Bristol via France. Okay. But he was never going to go to Scotland or Ireland or Wales or Australia or Australian Rugby Union. I should say, sorry, because or New Zealand Rugby Union either, because you can't afford it.
Yeah,
they just don't play in that market. The only three country leagues that play in that market at the real top end are England, France, and Japan. So you can't change that, and wishing won't make it so. So countries like Scotland should say, well, that's fine. We can't change it, but we need to find a way where we have a slightly different agenda. So our clubs and the national team are meant to be integrated. And so we have to run a different type of system, a little bit more like the Kiwi system, and the Australian system, whereby we limit the number of overseas or non-Scottish qualified players in it. Because we've got to have enough Scottish players and we can guarantee them places. And B, we haven't got the monetary resources to compete at the very, very top end of the global market. Okay? And anyway, is that really what we should be doing? It's an interesting philosophical question. So you then go, all right, well, okay, so here's the number of contracts and how many do we let go to England or France or whatever? And do they reach a certain level where, or a certain age? You know, I mean, Stuart Hogg played, I don't know how many years for Edinburgh. Finn Rusbauer, I don't know how many years, but they played a fair old number of years in the system. Is it really a huge problem? Well, of course, it weakens the team. And here it comes again. Does it really weaken Scotland? I don't think it weakens Scotland. Does it weaken Edinburgh and Glasgow? Yes, it almost certainly does.
Yeah.
But if you paid the market rate for them and therefore kept them, and you're going to assume they would stay for the market rate, which is a moot point, because there may be all kinds of non-monetary reasons why they fancy going to play somewhere else for a while, that's taken a lot of money out of that could be spent in other areas. And I can see that people say, but we want Glasgow to win stuff. We want Edinburgh to win stuff. And I totally understand that. And there's an intricate balancing mechanism there. And Ireland, we could come back to Ireland. Ireland get around it because they just produce. I mean, the Dublin player factory is extraordinary. It's probably right up there with the very, very best in the world. Certainly Wales has got nothing to match it. When you look at the number of players that Leinster Schools Cup competition produces year after year after year, and you look at the number of schools who are serious contenders for that now who didn't used to be. You know, it isn't like just the Blackrocks and the Terraneers. Are very, very historic. So there are other types of schools that have come in now and are genuine contenders. That model is a really interesting one, and that has enabled Ireland to support four teams, albeit the other advantages we mentioned earlier, you know, empty season and all the rest, empty market and all the rest of it. But they do generate a significantly high proportion. And actually, they produce almost... First of all, Leinster produces so many, they're now going to populate the other provinces. Right? So you see a lot of Leinster juniors now going to Munster or Ulster, Connacht. And even Ulster now, which never used to happen for other reasons. And that's enabled them. They almost produce... You can never produce too many, but you know, you'll now start to see increasingly, but where did he come from? And he's, you know, this guy playing in an English team. Think, oh look, he's Irish. He's from Leinster. And that's a much cheaper, more effective, and longer term model. And again, it's player development, and the Irish Rugby Union benefit from that because they don't have to pay for it. Because all the costs are borne by the schools. It happens to, it's also to a degree in Munster and to a degree in Ulster, schools rugby in Ireland is very, very strong. And it produces a steady supply of high quality rugby players, even though their player base is not enormous. And it's not. You look at the Irish player base, it's bigger than Scotland's, yes it is. But it's not a ridiculously big number, because an awful lot of Irish boys and girls play Gaelic soccer or hurl. You know, so they don't have rugby league. I mean, that's the only, but they're neither does Scotland to any great degree. And you know, England still, but England's got so many more people. The fact that rugby league is dominant in a small part of the country is, well, they can absorb it. You know, the fact that France is so big that, although it's starting to change a little bit with the FFR's thing and the way they promote one side from Fed one as long as they're north of a line, and the rise of places like Rennes and the Rouen increasingly, you know, it's starting to shift. It'll take many, many years. You've got to look at what you can do rather than waste an awful lot of time saying, well, why can't we be like put in your country of choice, when actually the framework they're working within and the culture they're working in is completely different.
It's an interesting point around the private school dominance in Leinster and that in Dublin rather, and that feeding into Leinster, because Ian Morrison, the former Scotland flanker, he wrote a piece recently on a sort of Scottish rugby blog, basically arguing that Scotland in some senses actually have a similar structure in place, because ultimately when you look at the teams that will, the best schoolboy teams in Scotland, it tends to come from Edinburgh private schools, so Merkiston Castle, Stuart's Melville, Watson's.
There is an equivalent of Leinster in Scotland.
Yeah. But I think for whatever reason, people suggesting that as a basis for sort of player development and success at the club and national level, it's almost like it's taboo. It's not something that people want to pursue, because obviously there's this tension with growing the game in Scotland beyond this small handful of private schools. Yes.
I think that's to confuse, or rather to conflate two very different things. And maybe it's because in Ireland, for example, Limerick, not the biggest, but the fourth biggest city, I think, in Ireland. So Dublin, Belfast, I think Cork's a bit bigger than Limerick. And in Limerick, it's a classless game. You know, it's played by all different classes. Whereas in Dublin, historically and traditionally, it's been a very middle-class game based around private schools, Dublin 4, etc., etc.
Mm.
Ulster has traditionally been a Protestant game. I know you're probably, but it has. You look at it, and that's changing as the intake of some of the traditionally Protestant private schools becomes more mixed. So you're getting more people from the other community playing the game.
Mm.
So, and at the same time, you go, look, it's not either or. I've never understood this. Okay, never understood this. And the example I always give is, think of one of our great, a different sport. Think about one of our great Olympic teams, Red Garave and Pinson. You know, Steve Redgrave went to a secondary modern school in Marlow. Yeah? Failed the 11 plus. It's in Buckinghamshire. They still, one of the few places in England still has a selection at 11. Failed the 11 plus, went to a secondary modern school, and Matt Pinson went to Eton.
Mm.
But in a boat together, they were one of the greatest oarsmen this country or the world has ever seen. Just a phenomenal team, right?
Mm.
I don't buy this idea that somehow by developing your advantage in one sector or one section means you're not working in another, right? I just don't get it. You know, the fact that most rugby players out of Leinster, and they're not, and actually they have widened it. They have. If you look at the schools in it now compared to 30 or 40 years ago, it has widened. It is still predominantly private, but not exclusively. And it certainly hasn't stopped Ireland developing Limerick rugby, where private school input into that is very, very limited. Not entirely, again, not negligible, because Cork's slightly different.
Yeah.
You look at what you've got and you build on it, in my view. You don't say, oh God, we feel slightly embarrassed about that. That's nuts. That's absolutely crazy. And I have a different type of criticism of some of the English development systems, whereby I would say it's fair comment that the RFU and English rugby development has not really had a serious go, over a generation or two, because that's how long it takes, at certain parts of the country, we're very, very weak in highly urbanised areas.
Yeah.
Okay. London, particularly, inner London rugby, there's virtually nothing there. You know, you look at some big, big cities, and there are challenges in big cities. Of course there are, in terms of facilities, etc., etc. But England's got so many, it almost doesn't need to. Scotland, on the other hand, and I don't claim any great detailed knowledge of the Scottish rugby market, but Scotland needs to maximise its anything it's got. So, again, we mentioned earlier, the borders, if it's well managed, will still produce a lot of players because of the culture of the sport within those communities. The Edinburgh private school system could, I don't know how good, bad or indifferent it is, but you want to build that and supplement it because you're not starting from scratch. Glasgow is a fantastic success story in a difficult market that you ought to be able to leverage into greater participation. It's not a question of doing one or other of those three. It's about doing them all and then deciding how much resource to allocate given what you've got. I've never understood this, we mustn't do that because we're already strong there. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's in the same way that people say, well, we've got to extend the reach of rugby. We've got to we've got to get new audiences. And I'm absolutely passionate about that. But it doesn't mean that you have to go and get all your new audience from complete areas where at the moment you've got absolutely none. You can get bigger market share of what you've already got. You know, so you can say, well, we're pretty strong in Edinburgh, but could you be stronger? And the answer is almost certainly, yes, you could. And so this growth thing, it doesn't matter, in my opinion, where it's from. You just want to get the numbers up.
Yeah.
Because you get into a virtuous circle. And if you get into a virtuous circle, things become much, much easier.
And from it's super fascinating. And from, you know, your experience with the Melbourne Storm, for instance, or even with the netball league, what were the sort of, I know that it's probably quite a broad question, but the main things that rugby union could learn from those kind of organisations?
There's a lot of examples around the world of sport, if you look and you care to spend some time studying it, that can be used by any sports. And I think culturally as a sport, rugby union in certain parts of the world has been, with a small c, conservative.
Yeah.
It's, I suppose, the flip side of its heritage as well, and also that whole lost century thing, where lots of the things that most other sports have gone through, rugby union was able not to do that because it chose not to, and it didn't need to, because it was amateur. And there were some great advantages to that, as we said. But now, I think that the game is still, to quite a significant degree, playing catch-up. And look, huge strides have been made. I just don't think we're anywhere near where we could be. And some of the things we do make it more difficult for ourselves. And then individual countries have particular issues that need to be addressed that don't exist in others. I mean, where I was brought up in Wales, it's a rugby country, which is culturally true. That is true. It's always had higher participation in football, by the way.
Right.
The cultural resonance of rugby in Wales. Someone once said rugby is is a game of small countries and minorities. It's not quite true, but it has an element of truth in it.
Mm.
And it's the one sport that Wales can show itself as being competitive on a truly global stage in a team sport. Although I still have very, very fond memories of following, you know, the European Euro 2016 semi-final.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was one. That's the first time Wales had ever been at a European or World Cup since 1958. You know, it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
But Wales has got some, you know, Wales and look, might get a Grand Slam again this year, and they've won a number recently, and it's been a golden era for the national team. It has. Look at it historically. The last 10, 15 years has been a real golden era for the team. But the game's got some serious challenges. I mean, the regional sides are not strong. The crowds are not particularly high.
Mm.
The danger is you become a one-team country, the national team, and they're sitting right next door to a much richer, larger market.
Mm.
There's some real challenges there. But I think I said, in the same way you say to Scott, you look at what you've got and you build on that. And that's true for all sports, rugby league, rugby union, football, it doesn't matter. You look at what you've got. You don't waste your time wishing you had other advantages or fewer disadvantages. You're realistic and you look at it and say, right, well, this is the amount of resource we've got. This is where we are. Where do we allocate the resources that we've got?
Mm.
How do we get more resources? But how do we allocate the ones we've got most effectively? And there's always a tendency to keep putting resources in and using resources in the same way that you always have done. And that's not always, you know, very effective. I mean, that's why, you know, that you hear it in Wales, oh, we need to go back to the club system. And come on, guys. We have 18 first class, in inverted commas, clubs. 18.
Yeah.
In a market of less than, a market of about 2 million.
Mm.
I'm sorry, that's ludicrous. They talk about Sydney being the most overpopulated sports market in the world because they've got nine rugby league clubs in a city of 5 million. Okay, so that's roughly, you know, 500,000 for each club. Well, you know, if Wales had a population of 9 million, then you'd do it, and it would still be overpopulated with clubs. It's the fact that it used to be, and people have very fond memories of it, and then you look at some of the video, and you watch these clips, there's nobody there. Honestly, you know, this sort of mythical golden era when Aberavon against Ponty Creed was a blockbuster. I mean, it's just not true.
Yeah.
And we've got to try and explain what we're doing, and we need to try and be realistic and take a long view, and because some of these things take a generation to shift in any significant way. And that's quite difficult in the modern era when, you know, instant gratification and silver bullets, you know, fix it now, is terribly, terribly fashionable.
I think there's a similar rose-tinted view of when the borders were around, because ultimately, you know, some great players came out of it. Like Chris Custer played, you know, Richie Vernon played, people like that who like were good Scottish players, but I think they would have come through regardless.
Look, Matt, good players will come. The very good players will come out. Will come through any system, right?
Mm.
The job of a governing body or a large professional club is to make sure there are more of them, and that the standard keeps improving. And you know, it's like these, you know, and don't get me wrong, I think there are some things about the game that we need to change, the game itself, I do, but this idea that suddenly it's a terrible game and it was all so much better years ago, I always say to people, I think again it was in the book, and Mike Elwood feels even strongly and more strong about this than I do, because I think some of the elements of modern rugby are really pretty dull.
Yeah.
I mean, this goal line stands, you know, whereby you go through 28 rucks making a millimetre at a time, you know, grunt and shunt. Just terrible. Just a terrible, terrible thing to watch.
Mm.
But if you think, you know, it wasn't like that in the old days. No, it wasn't. It was a damn sight worse. Go and have a look on YouTube at some of the sort of 1970s Lions tests against New Zealand.
Yeah.
The sort of the epitome of you know, the myth of, you know, and look, I grew up with it. I watched them all playing for Canada. You know, Barry John, Gareth Edwards and Gerald Davis, JPR, David Duckham, Fran Cotton, Willie John, and all the legends of people, you know, my age. The rugby was terrible.
I
loved it at the time, but I go and look at it and I go, oh my God, they tackle, there's no defence, where's the line speed, there's 50 scrums, there's knock-ons, it's just, and in amongst it, some absolutely beautiful bits of individual team play.
Yeah.
But you know, if you ever watch that Barbarians New Zealand game again from when it's 72, is it? You know, the greatest game ever played. You know, Phil Bennett. You know, look at the whole game. Watch the whole game, right?
Yeah. Seriously. I think.
It was a great game.
Yeah.
Watch the whole game. Some of it was. If you put that on today for people, they'd howl you out of town.
Probably the match that. Or at least the televised match that is probably the most famous in Scottish rugby history is that 1990 Grand Slam decider, which as an occasion, you know, it's unsurpassed. But you watch it again, and it is genuinely unwatchable. And the refereeing, just the laws around at the time didn't make any sense. There's definitely that rose tinted view of things.
This idea that, you know, the game, and this is not just true of rugby, that there was a golden era and everything was brilliant, is almost always complete tosh.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to get your view on was the Pro 14 as a tournament, as a product, what you think of it, and whether you think this, what you think of the CVC investment, and whether that can improve things.
Right, not a competition I spend an awful lot of time viewing, it must be said. So I'm speaking from very limited knowledge here. I mean, there's only so many competitions you can keep up with.
Yeah.
Hours a day.
I don't think many neutrals pay that much attention to it.
Pro 14's got, and the introduction of the South African franchises may help this. The Welsh aren't strong enough. The Irish are too dominant. There are the higher profile players, for understandable reasons, don't play enough in the tournament or in the competition until the very final stages. And like the Premiership and the top 14 as well, this isn't a Pro 14 problem, but the Pro 14 suffers from it. Probably more so than the others, because it is, without hopefully offending it, it is a weaker product.
Yeah.
The narrative is very hard to follow, and that's because, and this is true of the other domestic club competitions. You go domestic. Let's call Pro 14 domestic. All right, just for it. So the three, you start with the domestic league. Yeah, you go to the Heineken Cup and the Challenge Cup, you go to internationals, and you go back to the league, then back to the Europe, and then back to the Six Nations, and then, you know, I mean, come on. Unless you're an absolute rugby head, and a rusted-on diehard, it's incredibly hard to follow.
Yeah.
There's what sports marketing people would call the narrative is really, really difficult. It's not easy to follow. And one of my sort of arguments at the moment is it's because we have so much overlap and we don't put the season into blocks. But the only way, and you think, well, why can't you do that? Well, at the moment, you can't do that at the moment because all three, Europe, international rugby, and domestic leagues, are taking up too many weeks. All three of them. All three of them. You cannot, and the top 14 is even worse because they play 26 game season, right? So you cannot put the game in all three areas, so the European game in the three leagues, you cannot slot that into much fewer blocks with a much clearer narrative and far fewer overlaps, which will help the playing of the higher profile players, unless all three of them reduce the number of weeks they need to deliver their part of the package. All of them. Not one of them. You know, we've spent 25 years saying we're not making enough money. What's the answer? Put on more games. And yeah, if you're not careful when you do that, you lose the narrative and people lose interest. Okay, we're not the only sport that's done that. English Super League Rugby League's done exactly the same. It starts in February and ends in October. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But at least they don't get interrupted a lot. They're just too long, so that the teams play each other too often and people get bored.
Yeah.
You know, less can sometimes be more. And until all those three parties agree that they will reduce the number of weeks they occupy, not by an awful lot. It's interesting, when you do the work, and unsurprisingly I have, and look at it, right, what could it look like if, you know, you take a week away from the internationals, you take a couple of weeks away from the Premiership, and you take a week away from Europe, you basically collectively lose 4 or 5 weeks, the whole thing is changed. And that, I think, would do an enormous amount of good for all three domestic leagues. Well, certainly the two, the Pro 14 / 16 and the Premiership. France is slightly different because obviously people forget this. You know, they've been playing for the Bouclier for, you know, well over 100 years. Its heritage and tradition is way, way, way above anything else in European rugby, club rugby. But I think that would help in directly answering your question. The Pro 14 and 16, whatever it's going to be, it would help if you could play it in much bigger blocks that people, so that it, they have their time in the sun. I also don't think that the Pro 14 needs to be in conferences. We are obsessed in this country, and it's the football influence again, we are obsessed in this country, we've got a league of, doesn't matter the number, we must play each other home and away. Well, why? I mean, NRL don't play each other home and away. NFL don't play each other home and away. The AFL don't play each other home and away. They say, no, we've got room for this many games. We'll work the fixture list out that way. And that's what we should be doing. We should decide how many weeks we can, given the other requirements of the sport in this part of the world, how many weeks can we legitimately allocate to the domestic leagues? How much can we legitimately allocate to Europe? And how much can we legitimately allocate to international rugby? And there might, and reduce the overlaps, if not to zero, then to far, far fewer than we've got at the moment. And not just the overlaps, that we allow the competitions to breathe by, you know, you can, for example, as I say, I've played around with it, you can actually get a domestic league done and then play Europe in an 8-week block once it's finished. You could do that.
Yeah.
You can't do it now. It's too many weeks. Can't be done.
Mm.
But you could. You could. You could basically play the domestic. It's too detailed for a podcast, but you know, it requires all three, who traditionally have fought each other for weekends, because that's what it's been for the last 25. No, we want that. No, we want it. We want it. If everybody took a bit less, I firmly believe everybody would be a bit better off.
I suppose that's, yeah, you're asking teams to sacrifice a home game in some instances, and the see, gate receipts.
There you go. You've done it as well.
I'm not saying, I'm just trying to get, I'm trying to no, put...
Well, actually, the. What happens, of course, is at the moment, the squads are far too big. Because we play too many games.
Yeah.
You know, the Premiership play the Premiership, they play the Premiership Cup, they play it's ridiculous. And they play age group, they play... So, we're adding on costs to have bigger squads, and not just bigger squads, because when you have bigger squads, you need bigger support staff and bigger coaching teams, and etc. And everybody likes to add on another team because people like it. And teams are really expensive. I remember when they started the academy system in England, the philosophy was, we're not going to run a team. We're not. Because a new team needs a coach and a manager and a physio and a strength and conditioning and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are 10, you know, we go on 20 years, everyone's got an under-18s. Everyone's got an under-16s. And I just don't think that's what professional clubs, certainly in an English-type system, I don't think that's what they should be doing. They should be running a squad of, I don't know, 38? That's it.
Mm.
Maybe 40. No overlap, okay? And if you lose, when the internationals are playing, you're not. And you, at the moment, you've got squads in England, if you add in their academies and all the rest of it, they've got more than 55 people on the payroll. And you can't tell me that that reduction in costs wouldn't more than compensate for losing one or two home games. I'm sorry, the numbers, you're not wrong. Mm. Numbers are clear. So that's a very much broader answer to a question about the Pro 14-16, but I think it's very, very hard to answer about Pro 14-16 without looking at it within the way that European rugby is structured.
And so, I mean, I think it would make a lot of sense to, or I understand the arguments around a South African team or even Italian teams coming into a British league and it just not resonating with your average fan. And you get to this situation where the Pro 14 is trying to market, you know, Zebre against the Cheetahs.
Yeah. And the Super Rugby had the same problem.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a lot easier, and look, but there's no getting around this. It's a lot easier to market a one country competition.
Mm.
Yeah, it is. For England and France have a lot of advantages in that sense. But the fact is that no other country in the world of rugby, other than Japan, has got a big enough market to run a viable domestic-only competition. So it's a waste of time to fret about the fact that it can't be done in Wales or Ireland or Scotland or Italy or South Africa or Australia or New Zealand. You just go get on and get the most attractive competition you can from what you've got. And then will that always be a disadvantage for a multinational league? Yeah, it will. Yeah, to be honest, it will.
Hmm.
So, but you can't change that. You know, that horrible... That's not a horrible cliche. It's a good cliche. It's a nice cliche. That cliche you hear from sports people all the time. Control the controllable. You know, I know it's become so well known that since Michael Johnson or Ed Moses is one of the two popularized it. It applies to the administration of sport as well. You know, it's like you're running track and field and you'd like to have, you'd love your athletes to be as good as the Kenyans, but they're not.
Yeah.
Well, what do you do? Just give up? No, you just, you try and maximise the most you can from the situation you're in.
And what's your view more broadly on private equity, CVC style money coming in? Because it seems to have been broadly accepted as a positive without maybe being subjected actually to that much scrutiny.
It would be ludicrously hypocritical of me to be, say I don't like private capital, I use that phrase quite deliberately, coming into the sport, because that's ridiculous, because I've made a living and my second career out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Going back, you know, and but any organisation, this is never mind sport, but any organisation, why do they require private capital? The reason they require private capital is that they can't generate enough capital internally to do all the things they would like to do to make higher revenues, a multiple of revenues down the line in the future. You know, that's why companies debt finance. That's why companies look for investment. And if the investment comes in, which in sport means you, in exchange, you give up a percentage of the revenues you've already created.
Yeah.
Be it 10%, 15%, whatever. If you use the money coming in to, and allocate it to developments that lead to increased revenue down the line, then that's a really good idea. Because you won't miss the 10% you're no longer getting, because the overall generation of revenue has grown by a bigger percentage, so you're better off. If, however, the private capital that comes in, whether it's from individual high net worths or whether it's from private equity firms or from VCs, it doesn't really matter. If the capital that comes in, however, is used to shore up finance losses ongoing for another 5 or 6 years, or is squandered by increasing salaries for staff or players or coaches because the cash is there, so well, it's easier to just, you know, well, we can do that now. Well, that won't generate a single extra pound down the line. Then I think it's a pretty poor idea. I think there's some very good examples of private equity coming into sports and having a really positive impact. I like the look of the New Zealand deal with Silver Lake, which looks to me like being very much along the lines of putting a fair bit of that investment into sort of creation of direct to consumer platforms and enhancing digital capability and unlocking revenue streams that currently they can't unlock because they haven't got the capital themselves to make that investment. I think it can be really positive. But I think there are, if it goes into other directions and into other uses, it can be really, really damaging.
Do you think that CVC have their heart set on putting the Six Nations behind a paywall, for instance?
I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know, so I shouldn't.
No, fair enough. I think it's
I'm not party to what they're. I'm not party to the. I have never seen. I've been told lots of things, but I've never seen what the deal is with the Pro 14 or the Six Nations or the Premiership. I mean, I think I know some of it, but I've never seen it in black and white, so I'm always a bit cautious about commenting when you haven't got the evidence.
Yeah, no, I think it's just a question that we've asked, you know, if that is part of their strategy and, you know, that the SRU's aim is to grow the game in Scotland. That's its mission statement, that's its purpose. We kind of feel like there haven't been enough people asking those questions around things like putting Six Nations behind a paywall and how the money gets allocated, that sort of thing, which obviously people will be having those discussions, but it's potentially something that, you know, could have a bigger impact down the line.
Yeah, it could. It all depends. It's a trade-off, isn't it? And this is not a rugby argument, this is a whole sports argument. There's always a trade-off between making your sport accessible to large numbers of people, if you happen to be lucky enough to have that type of audience, or whether you maximise your revenue to reinvest in the sport by maximising your broadcast revenues, which clearly you will have higher broadcast revenues if you choose to go into some kind of subscription rights-based model. I mean, that's pretty self-evident. I suppose I sit in the camp that says I just want to look at and see what each individual deal looks like before I comment on whether that is overall a good or a bad thing for the game. I think you also have to be grown up and recognise that if you do take investment from private equity firms, you know, they are very upfront about what they're after. They're after a return. So, and that's their role. I'm not being critical. That's their business. So, you know, whether the whole thing a lot of people are saying, you know, it's a roll-up play, and the broadcast revenues are undervalued, the broadcast rights are undervalued. Maybe true. I mean, that's what they clearly believe, and time will tell whether that's right or not.
Great, Mark. Well, I think that's been really, really interesting. Thank you so much for your time. I think you've given listeners like plenty of food for thought.
Thank you for asking me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.